debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Whether it's aches and pains or wanting to sleep better or just thinking that, you know, it's a good idea to take things that are anti-inflammatory. Inflammation just ravages our bodies. New Leaf Naturals CBD oil does it, as does, I mean, you know, it's CBD, and this is what CBD does, but this is the best form. CBD oil doesn't get you high. It's not intoxicating. You get the health benefits of cannabinoids without the mind-altering effects of medical marijuana. It's non-toxic. It has potent pain-relieving and anti-inflammatory properties. It's so non-toxic, you can give it to your pets. The brand I trust the most is New Leaf Naturals, NU Leaf Naturals, the highest quality CBD oil on the market. It's 100% organic. It's highly concentrated. It contains no additional additives. It's grown right here in the USA, and the only ingredient is hemp. So the product remains in its most pure and simple form. Go to newleafnaturals.com. That's NUleafnaturals.com. Save 30% off and get free shipping in the U.S. when you use the code TOM, spelled T-H-O-M. Go to NUleafNaturals.com for premium cannabinoid wellness. There's only one place, newleafnaturals.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, some extraordinary news out there. A woman in El Salvador who had been charged with murder for having a stillbirth just got a new trial and released. We're going to get into that and what that has to do with Mike Pence and what's going on in the United States in a few moments. I'm curious your thoughts on Trump's worst policies. We'll get into that in just a minute. And, you know, I've got my own private list. I mean, you know, deregulate, or to a certain extent, deregulating our banks, his giant tax cut, his putting an oil lobbyist in charge of the Interior Department, putting a coal lobbyist in charge of the EPA, his putting a private school lobbyist and advocate in charge of the Education Department, his naked embrace of white supremacy with regard to his, or white nationalism with regard to his Stephen Miller-inspired immigration policies. It just goes on and on and on. The Title 10 program, I want to get into that too a little bit today. Title 10 serves 4 million women, virtually all low-income women. Title 10 is a program that, you know, under its aegis, you can get support for housing if you're low-income. You can also get support for medical services. And if you're a woman and you want reproductive system medical services, you want to be tested for sexually transmitted diseases or HIV, you want to get birth control. The birth control is the most common. I mean, this is probably 90% of what, you know, Planned Parenthood does. Well, actually, I shouldn't throw out a percentage. I don't know the amount, but I know that it's a very, very large part of what they're doing. And about 40% of all Title 10 patients are being served right now. That is, women who have reproductive health needs are being served right now by Planned Parenthood. And the Trump administration gag rule says that if you even mention to a woman who is pregnant or even considering pregnancy or worried about pregnancy, if she's been raped, for example, and doesn't know yet, you know, it's too early to tell. If you mention to her the possibility of abortion, you're toast. That's just, you know, that's the end of the discussion. And this is pretty breathtaking when you think about it. So now Planned Parenthood has said that rather than put a piece of tape over the mouths of their physicians and physicians' assistants and nurse practitioners and nurses and whatnot, rather than doing that so that they can't mention the A word, they're going to just stop taking federal money, which means that the funds that pay for the medical services for 4 million women right now through Title X via Planned Parenthood is going to go away. And this is just nakedly part of the white male war on women in the United States. Title X is part of the U.S. federal code that part of it prohibits certain types of discrimination, but the part of it that most Americans are familiar with actually subsidizes things like housing and health care for low-income people and very poor people. It's, you know, the Title X housing vouchers, you know, subsidized housing, Title X services. So if you qualify for these services, there are approved vendors for Title X money. And one of them was Planned Parenthood. And then the Trump administration came along and said, if you even mention the word abortion in any context, if a woman who has been raped comes into your clinic and says, I've been raped, what are my options? I'm not even sure if I'm pregnant, but what are my options? And you say, well, let's see, there's the morning after pill, there's abortion, there's carrying the baby to term, there's, you know, getting prenatal care, there's, you know, checking for sexually transmitted diseases. I mean, there's all these, here's an educational program on the, you know, the first trimester of pregnancy and how important it is to have a healthy baby if that's what you decide to do, et cetera. But if you mention the word abortion, boom, no more money for any part of your organization in any way. If any of your providers even mention that word, thus the word gag rule, right? So Trump and Pence have gagged any physician who wants to take any federal money for serving women. Now, this is part of their war on women, which is kind of a subtext of not just white supremacy, white nationalism, but male supremacy and male nationalism. It's about keeping white men in charge of the country and making more white men, making sure that white women don't have abortions. That, you know, regardless, I mean, you know, Steve King, you know, on the record saying, well, you know, there's these terrible things that have happened to women over history, but they produce babies, so let's not have exemptions to the ban on abortions. I mean, that was his whole shtick. Right? So that's a pretty pernicious policy. Trump's FCC ended net neutrality. I mean, that's mind-boggling. That's huge. Right now, your internet service provider can censor your internet. And you have no say over it. You have no control over it. If you want to visit progressive websites, they can slow them down. They can block them entirely. You might not even find that they exist. They can track absolutely everything you're doing and sell that information. They can see your passwords. They can see your bank account. They can see everything you do. Your internet service provider, whatever internet service you have, including the one on your cell phone. And this is a policy that was done by Ajit Pai, who is a Verizon lobbyist, a lobbyist that Trump put in charge of the FCC. You know, he likes to put lobbyists in charge of things. You got a coal lobbyist running the EPA. You got an oil lobbyist running the Interior Department, supervising all our public lands. Or maybe it's the other way around, coal and oil. But in any case, you've got, you know, a private school lobbyist, Betsy DeVos, not just lobbyist, but donor. I mean, you know, contributing hundreds of millions of dollars, or millions of dollars anyway, to the movement to kill public education and replace it with private schools, which, you know, came out of the Brown versus Board of Education ruling that said that public schools have to be integrated. You have to offer services to black kids as well as white kids. And, you know, Betsy DeVos and all her white buddies in northern Michigan are like, oh, my God, we can't have that. Fascinating stuff. So what are Donald Trump's very worst policies? Tim in Aloha, Oregon. Hey, Tim, your contribution, your vote.
Yeah, the biggest problem is, and it was what he does every morning, he gets up and he turns on Fox News, because that's going to dictate basically everything he's doing. Rupert Murdoch and Sean Hannity have him in their back pocket.
Right.
People don't, understand how illiterate that man is. That's the scary part, you know.
Yeah.
They talk about how he makes determinations on policy and stuff. He's not doing that. That's all dictated to him. You know,
oh, look at what happened with gun control. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, he was saying to Republican members of Congress, you guys are afraid of the NRA. I'm not afraid of the NRA. And now it's like, okay, whatever the NRA says, that's what we'll do.
You know, Fox News, the effect they're having on this country is scary stuff. You know, there's a guy that lives fairly close to me in my neighborhood, and he watches it all the time. And I said to him, I said, what do you think of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and ISIS? He said, well, those are terrorist organizations. He said, if we don't be careful, they're going to take over the world. And I said, no, that's already been done. And he said, who's that? And I said, the Republican hierarchy, the NRA, Rush Limbaugh, and Fox News. I said, what they're doing now is destroying us generational. It's scary stuff. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's our own homegrown Taliban. Thank you. Thank you, Tim, for your contribution. So, you know, they just rolled back the Endangered Species Act. So, you know, you can see bald eagles vanishing again and grizzly bears. And I mean, you know, the list goes on and on and on. I mean, Trump is now offering for sale on his website plastic straws because, you know, own the libs. Right. Even though we're finding all these marine mammals dying on our beaches, and when they autopsy them, their stomachs are full of plastic, and the straws are getting inside like turtles' mouths and some of these fish and choking them, and they, you know, they can't digest them or process them. Now they're poking the eyes out of marine animals. What do you think is the worst Trump policy? They've said, okay, you can shoot wolves again. I believe that they've changed the policy on wild horses. I mean, they pulled us out of the Paris Accords, the whole climate change thing. Literally, the entire Republican Party lives in such fear of the Koch brothers who made their fortune, you know, with fossil fuels. Their daddy made his fortune drilling for oil for Joe Stalin and then came to the United States and built the John Birch Society and expanded his fortune here in the United States in the oil business. And so, you know, thou shalt not speak of climate change if you're a Republican and you want Koch money, which is most of the money out there for Republicans. I mean, that's a pretty grim policy. I'm just doing this off the top of my head. I mean, you know, but what do you think are the absolute worst policies that Trump has promulgated? Whether they're ones at law, in other words, ones that Congress has passed, and of course, Congress has passed very few laws in the last 3 years, but or 2.5 years, but, you know, if at law, or things that he's done by executive order, or people he's put into places, like, you know, Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. What, in your opinion, is the worst thing that the Trump administration has done that maybe we can fix if we get a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress? Hi, it's the Tom Hartman Book Club with the Tom Hartman University, and today we're reading from Threshold, the Progressive Plan to Pull America Back from the Brink. I'm reading from the preface. This is page XIII. The world right now is tottering atop three major thresholds. An environment that is so afire that it may soon no longer be able to support human life. An economic free market system that is almost entirely owned, run, and milked by a tiny fraction of 1% of us and has crashed and in many ways is burning around us. And an explosion of human flesh on the planet that has turned our species into a global petri dish just waiting for an infective agent to run amok. Four mistakes have brought us to this point, and the failure to recognize them at their deepest level will only push us faster toward total tipping points where we are thrown over the three thresholds and into disaster. All four of these mistakes are grounded in our culture, our way of thinking, our way of seeing the world, the stories we tell ourselves about who we are and why we're here. The first mistake is a belief that we're separate from nature. Our religions tell us that we were created by a supernatural being who is not part of this earth and not from this planet. He set us apart from all other life, and many among us, perhaps even the majority of the 6 billion of us, roughly 7 billion now, don't even believe that we are animals, but instead think we're a totally unique life form. The second mistake is a belief that an abstraction, an economic system, is divine and separate from us. This mythical so-called free market, so we believe, operates under its own divine rules and is entirely and eternally self-regulating. It is always right. The fact that worldwide it's more than 95% owned and run by fewer than 0.00001% of us. It's just the way things are, always were, and always will be. We are here to serve the economy, this belief goes. It's not here to serve us. The third mistake is a belief that men should run the world and that women are their property. While it may seem that women's rights are well advanced and society is nearly egalitarian in the developed world, the United States, Western Europe, and Australia combined are only about a quarter of the population of the world. In India, it's still a common rural practice for men to burn their wives to death simply because it's more convenient than divorce. In many Arab countries and across much of Africa and South America, it's not uncommon for women to be murdered by their families if they dishonor the family by not going along with an arranged marriage or not being a virgin at time of marriage. Even in the first world, women are routinely excluded from positions of power in the world's largest institutions, such as the Catholic Church. This is one of our biggest mistakes, not just because it's morally deficient or because it can be biologically challenged, but because its primary result is an explosion in population. The fourth mistake is a belief that the best way to influence people is through fear rather than through the power of love, compassion, or support. We stand baffled when Palestinians in Gaza vote for a political party that has a long history of terrorist activity, somehow completely overlooking the fact that that same group has been feeding people, building schools and hospitals, and providing old age and widow pensions to people in need. We think we can threaten and bomb people into liking us and behaving in ways consistent with our best interests while ignoring their own best interests. We have come to believe that we are not our brother's keeper, that we are separate from all other humanity on the planet. And in all that, we are mistaken. Civilizations have come and gone, and those long gone vanished mostly because they despoiled their commons, allowed small elites to control their economies and governments, and lived in ways that were unsustainable. Those who survived for centuries or millennia are the ones that learned how to protect their commons, engage in non-toxic commerce and governance, and organize their cultures and lifestyles in ways that could continue in the same place and the same way down through the ages. If we don't learn the lessons of the latter, we shall face the fate of the former. The book is Threshold, the progressive plan to pull America back from the brink. You know, we've tried all kinds of things over the years to help us sleep better, from, you know, weird lights that go on and off at various times, to white noise machines, to weighted blankets and all kinds of stuff. But imagine a bed, since the temperature of your body has an enormous amount to do with how well you sleep, how long you sleep, and how deep you sleep. Imagine a bed that actually adjusts its temperature to your needs minute by minute throughout the night. It's here. It's called the Pod by 8 Sleep. It's brand new. It's the ultimate sleep machine. The Pod is the first and only high-tech bed designed to help you achieve peak mind and body performance. Helps you sleep deeper, gives you information on how you sleep. It tracks your biometrics, and you don't need to wear anything. Want to sleep better? They've got personalized programs. It's extraordinary. You got to check this thing out. Because the better you sleep, the better you everything. Try the Pod for 100 nights, and if you don't love it, they'll refund your purchase and arrange a free pickup only at 8sleep.com/Tom, EIGHTsleep.com. They've already sold out their first two batches, and they're going, like I said, it's a new invention, a new product for a limited time. Get $150 off your purchase when you go to 8sleep.com/Tom, T-H-O-M. EIGHTsleep.com/T-H-O-M, 8sleep.com/Tom. There's another issue out there, and this is a little broader and a little less time specific, but it's happening to more and more of us every day. I am going to be speaking to a progressive group, and they sent me a, you know, just a simple contract, kind of a release, you know, yes, we'll put you on our platform if you'll blah blah. And in it was a forced arbitration clause. And I'm looking at this going, wait a minute. This contract is asking me to give up my rights under what I recall is the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. And by coincidence, the day after I got that, I got this email from Public Citizen saying, hey, guess what? There's something going on with these forced arbitration clauses. Remington A. Gregg is on the line with us. He is the Counsel for Civil Justice and Consumer Rights at Public Citizen, an attorney. Citizen.org is the website. You can tweet him at R.A. Gregg, spelled with three G's, G-R-E-G-G. Remington, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, let's start out with what is forced arbitration?
A forced arbitration clause is a provision in a take-it-or-leave-it contract, meaning you cannot say, I don't want this, I don't want that. That takes away your right to bring the employer or the company to court if you're harmed, if they cheat you, if you're the subject of discrimination, and it puts you instead in a privatized system, which is headed by an arbitrator. So besides choose an arbitrator, there is no judge, no jury, no ability to appeal. It's very, very difficult to appeal. And most egregiously, there is no requirement that the arbitrator follow the law or the fact. So it really is the wild west of the justice system.
Wow. And how does this tilt justice, for lack of a better word, tilt outcomes, let's say, in favor of big corporations and employers and against the individual who is signing the contract or a small company that might be signing a contract?
Well, in a variety of ways. So let's just take the beginning of it. So ostensibly, both sides get to choose the arbitrator, but you're going to go through this probably once in your life if you're lucky. The company goes through it a lot. So they know the business-friendly arbitrators. The arbitrators also
know. Or at least the lawyers for the company, right?
Exactly, right. Yeah. The arbitrators know that the companies are repeat players. So you tend to get more business-friendly arbitrators. That's one. Two.
So this is like judge shopping, like what's it called, jurisdiction shopping?
Right. Yeah, foreign shopping. If you're in court, judges don't get to choose what cases they have. There's a lottery system, and it's just the luck of the draw. It is not like that in arbitration. And then, of course, you're going to go to the arbitration. As I said, there is no requirement to follow the law or the facts. And so the arbitrator gets to basically decide these things however he or she believes it should be decided. And then, you know, a lot of these provisions have gag clauses, so you're not able to talk about the proceedings afterwards. So let's just think about that. There may be someone in the cubicle next to you that's having the same problem or who's being cheated by your employer out of your wages, and you're not able to talk to them about what happened or to be able to share evidence, which often happens not only just in the employment context, but in the antitrust context. When you have small businesses, they may need to prove that a huge corporation is an antitrust violator, but that costs a lot of money to prove that. And there's a lot of economic analysis there, and you're not able to share that economic analysis with another party. In every step of the way, from before you even go into arbitration, to in arbitration, to after arbitration, the deck is really tilted against you.
I was pretty shocked by this, and there was also a clause of the contract that said basically if I ever said anything bad about the company, this venue that puts on events for progressives, you know, that I was surrendering my right to do that. Under this contract, I was forbidden from doing that. And truth be told, that they would not trash talk me either. But there was another place in the contract where I was explicitly surrendering my right to, must not have been suing, because that's what the forced arbitration does. But there was another right that I was surrendering, where I explicitly said, you are surrendering your right. You know, and I said to the CEO of the company, I'm opposed to signing the, there's no way in hell I'm ever going to get in court with this company, right? I mean, you know, it's like we're both on the same side. We're not going to have any conflict. It's not going to happen. But nonetheless, I said to the CEO, you know, you're asking me to sign this thing just to appear in your venue. And, you know, it's asking me to surrender at least two of my constitutional rights. And I'd rather not. And the person on the other side said, well, if you don't, my lawyer will kill me. I mean, you know, if you ask me to take those out of the contract. And I'm like, what kind of lawyer do you have? I mean, did you call sharks.com? Or is this so ubiquitous and so common that even lawyers for progressive organizations are starting to incorporate this stuff routinely?
There's a chock full of stuff in what you said, but I'll take the last thing first, which is that it basically, because the Supreme Court over the last 30 years, in almost every case that has been presented to them, has given greater freedoms to companies to do this, it's almost malpractice not to. If you are a lawyer for a big company, regardless of ideology, it's basically malpractice to not put in something that has become standard and, as you said, ubiquitous. And that's what you're seeing. You're seeing people, companies react to the market. And specifically, a second thing that you mentioned, what you're talking about is probably a class action ban.
Yes, that's right. That's what it was. I would not participate in a class action lawsuit. You're right. Thank you for reminding me.
That's what people That's what people really hate. That's what big companies really hate. They hate the ability of people to band together against them.
Right. And this is a little tiny company, by the way, that's asking me to sign this. I doubt they have 20 employees, you know?
Right. Well, but see, but that, there you go. This, what this is it's just, you know, it's a copy and paste job now. You know, you see these standard, you know, you see this stuff that's standard in contracts, and you're just going to put in there because that's what you do, right? If you see it, that's what you
It's the new boilerplate, in other words.
Exactly. But the problem is that in 1925, when the Federal Arbitration Act was enacted, it was specifically intended to be for merchants, company to company, for a faster way to resolve disputes.
Right.
They did not envision in any way that this would be used against consumers, it would be used against workers, it would be used with people with unequal bargaining power, or that it would be used with such ubiquity. And that's right. The reason why it's so bad nowadays is because you cannot get away with it, and you cannot get away from the, as you said, boilerplate, take it or leave it types of contracts.
Right. Remarkable stuff. So bottom line, if somebody gets a contract, whether it's a mortgage contract from their bank or whether it's an employment contract or a contract to a release to speak in a theater or something, if there's forced arbitration in that contract, what should they do?
And also nursing home contracts, I'll have you know, which is pretty shameful.
It's probably in, you know, hire a contractor to fix your home. It's probably in there, too.
Yeah. I mean, you could try to cross it out and then sign next to it, but obviously most companies don't allow you to pick and choose. So if that's the case, then you could try to be a good consumer and try to shop places that don't have it, but right. It's certainly not something you can do if you're a worker. You got to take the job or you don't. So you have to be just really smart.
So I would be, I'm sorry we're hitting the break here, but I did want to mention there's an act, a piece of law, the FAIR Act, Forced Arbitration and Injustice Repeal Act, that you're calling on people to support. Call your congressman or woman, right?
Right. That's what Congress has to do something.
Okay. And support the FAIR Act so that we can get rid of forced arbitration. Great. Remington Gregg, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Mike Pence and the Republican war on women took a sinister turn this week when Planned Parenthood was forced to abandon Title X funding. So they can no longer get payment for serving low-income women for things like cancer screenings and sexually transmitted disease screenings and treatments. And the major thing that they do is provide free contraception. And, of course, the white supremacist movement, the white nationalist movement, is hysterical about the fact that there's more brown babies being born right now than white babies. And in rural white America, in poor rural white America, areas that overwhelmingly vote for Donald Trump and watch Fox News, the principal provider of birth control and STD services and family planning and occasionally abortion, you know, few and far between, frankly. But the principal provider for those services for low-income women in these white counties is Planned Parenthood. And therefore, the white supremacists and white nationalists want to take down Planned Parenthood because they don't want white women having access to abortion or contraception. Now, in urban areas where it's more likely to be African-American populations, it's not just Planned Parenthood. There are a lot of other providers that are offering services. But in rural America, in white America, in white rural America, it's pretty much Planned Parenthood. And Trump just took that down. Planned Parenthood said, okay, we're going to give up $260 million in Title X funding because of this gag rule that says that we can't mention the word abortion, even if a woman asks. We're not going to put tape over our doctors' mouths. It's not even about providing abortion. It's about saying, well, that's one of your options. You know, just south of us, El Salvador has accomplished what Mike Pence has been working toward his entire life, a complete ban on abortions. And this week, a woman who was arrested there and put in prison, she's been in prison for almost 3 years because she had a miscarriage. And the local police asserted that this miscarriage was the result of her an abortion attempt, or maybe she, you know, jumped down the stairs too hard or whatever, because she had been the victim of rape and therefore they were convinced that she was trying to abort the baby and she had a stillbirth or a miscarriage. I don't think it was long enough that you'd actually technically call it a stillbirth, and they arrested her and put her in prison. I mean, get ready, American women. Mike Pence already pushed legislation in Indiana that required women who have miscarriages or abortions to notify the police and to provide funerals for the remains. While the New York Times reports that numerous women across America are already being imprisoned for having miscarriages. 38 states now have laws that treat miscarriages as potential crime scenes because of so-called fetal homicide laws that have led to the imprisonment of American women who have had miscarriages as the result typically of either accidents where they've been prosecuted for like involuntary manslaughter. Oh, you had a car accident and you lost your pregnancy. You had a miscarriage. You lost the child or the potential child or the fetus or whatever it may be at whatever stage. Well, that was your fault. We're going to prosecute you as if you'd run over a little kid on the street by accident because fetuses are people now. Or a woman who tries to commit suicide, takes an overdose of pills or something like that, and she survives the suicide attempt. And whether or not she miscarries, oh, you might have harmed the baby. We're going to put you in prison. I mean, the Republican war on women is picking up steam. And what happens when women in America are totally disempowered like they are in El Salvador? And even, you know, an abusive or angry husband or neighbor could call the police and say, you know, the woman next door is 4 months pregnant, but I saw her smoking in the backyard, or I think that she's taking crack, or, I think that she's been jumping up and down on the trampoline because she's trying to abort or miscarry. And boom, the police show up and off that woman goes to jail. This is in 38 states. This can happen to you if you're female and pregnant. Whether it's true or not, if somebody's going to testify against you, bang, you go to jail. Rob in Cordville, Idaho, it says you disagree with me about Planned Parenthood?
I think you're telling the people lies. You're not bringing up the fact that Planned Parenthood was put together to kill off black babies.
No, Planned Parenthood was not put together to kill off black babies, yeah. Rob. That's
to kill off the black race in America.
It's simply not the case. You know, yeah, Margaret Sanger had some pretty weird views about euthanasia, but they were widely shared back at that time. They were shared by Woodrow Wilson, the president of the United States. But that was not the basis of Planned Parenthood. That's not why Planned Parenthood was started. B, that's not what Planned Parenthood ever did. And C, that's not what Planned Parenthood is up to now. And this is one of the most pernicious lies promoted by the people who want to make sure that white women can't get contraception and that white women can't get abortions because, gee, we need more white people. So picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery. Just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Don't believe it? I didn't either until I tried it. Now, I don't have to imagine it anymore. I look like me, but 10 years younger. Simply put, I'm blown away by the results. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is Plexiderm goes on clear, so nobody will know you're using it, unless you tell them, of course. Go to tryplexiderm.com and use my code Tom, T-H-O-M, for 50% off, plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off, plus an extra $10 off. This offer is only available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning the code Tom, T-H-O-M. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit tryplexiderm.com today and use the code Tom, T-H-O-M, at checkout. That's tryplexiderm.com.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
James in Spokane, Washington. Hey, James, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Nam Yoho Renge Kyo, my friend.
Back at you.
You've said before how Reagan disempowered unions and the working class and suppressed wages and stuff. Something I haven't heard you mention, but it's a big point. And believe me, I'm not a sexist. I'm not anti-woman. But around that same time, dovetailed right into his plans was the fact that women came whole scale into the workforce.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
In a big way, post Roe v. Wade, actually. And let's not forget, 1961 was when the birth control was legalized and introduced. And by 1968 or 1969, you had something like 70. I mean, the penetration was enormous, about 70% of the fertile female population in the United States that was using birth control had switched to birth control pills. And so by 73, when Roe v. Wade happened, women were using birth control pills, and then they had access to abortion after 73. So they had basically fully taken control of their reproductive timing, shall we say. And as a consequence of that, they could fully participate in the workforce even before there were protections for, you know, maternity leave and you can't fire women because they get pregnant and that kind of thing. None of that existed back in the 70s, but they were coming to the workforce in big numbers. So what's your point relative to that, James?
Well, I wonder if there was a PR campaign, because we know what the right is doing has been regimented since probably the end of World War II, if not before. I wonder if this was actually a plan, too, where they promoted it. Because I can't help but say that the children's welfare involves one of the parents, I think, or at least a close family member, being with them available to them at all times. You know, I don't think it's healthy for our society. For all
well,
the
you know, that's a pervasive theory, James, but now we've got about 30 or 40 years of good, relatively good and solid data on kids who basically grew up in daycare. And what we find is that they're not consequentially different than kids who grew up with one of the parents at home, that their ability to socially integrate is actually improved. They're more likely to be well socialized. Their vocabulary is actually larger than the vocabulary. In other words, they measure higher on IQ tests than kids who are raised by one of the parents staying home. There's actually some benefits to that. And the dire fear that they're going to be socially, culturally, emotionally disconnected from their own family has not seemed to exist either. Because, I mean, daycare is only 5, 6, 7, 8, at the most 9 hours a day. And the rest of the time, they're home with their families. So be careful with that story, James, because it's been pretty well debunked. But, you know, I get what you're saying. And women in the workforce, they're a real thing now. And it's, you know, it's not going away, and it's not a bad thing. And, you know, women are as much people as are men. So to try to villainize them for being in the workforce, you know, it's just it's a Republican thing, but it's not a thing that I think is real. So let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's up in the world today. This report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Loving What You Do, Ellen Ratner's new book. And on the line with us is Doug Christian. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Doing all right, Tom. How are you doing?
Good. What's on the news?
Well, we're in the dog days of summer. August recess is continuing until after Labor Day, so Capitol Hill is quite empty these days. And, of course, the Trump administration is working diligently to emasculate the EPA. But four automakers have agreed to go in with California's emissions regulations. Those automakers are Honda, Ford, Volkswagen, and BMW. Trump is trying to fight back. He's invited Toyota, Fiat, Chrysler, and General Motors to the White House to ask them, please don't join California.
In other words, lower your standards, car makers. Put more pollution in the air, please, because we need more people consuming more oil so that the Koch brothers' profits can continue to get recycled into the Republican Party.
That may be an opinion. I'm just reporting what I see here.
Yeah, thank you.
Mercedes-Benz has now joined the coalition, saying, no, we're going to stick by the emissions rules that California sets up.
Good on them. Good on them.
So, of course, now there are many economists that predict a looming recession with inversion of the bond yield curve.
Right.
And so Hogan Gidley from White House spokesman said, what I can tell you is the same thing that White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said, the same thing that the president of the United States has said, and that he's looking for tax cuts again, and we think that will spur on economic expansion. Today, right, the White House denies that they are actually looking for
That's because they'd have to get them through Congress, and there's no way Nancy Pelosi is going to pass a bill like that.
Absolutely not. House Democrats have already said so.
Yeah.
Now, Trump is saying that a looming recession is, quote, fake news. And he said, I don't think we're having a recession. We're doing tremendously well. Our consumers are rich. I gave a tremendous tax cut, even though we do believe that tax authorities come from Congress. But anyway, yeah. And they're loaded up with money, Trump told reporters.
Right. Aren't we all richer than ever before? in our dreams, right, Doug?
Yeah. So, but of course, this does threaten his reelection. So he's blaming the Fed. He's also blaming China and the European Union and distraction. He's tweeting that Representative Tlaib said, "Sorry, I don't buy her tears. I've watched her violence, craziness, and most importantly, words for far too long. Now tears? She hates Israel and all Jewish people. She is an anti-Semite."
Right. Which is a complete lie. This is Donald Trump lying.
Well, it's also a way to divide Israel into political...
Which is the worst possible thing that could happen to Israel, is for aid to Israel and the strength of our alliance with Israel to become a partisan issue. This is the absolute worst thing that could happen. And Netanyahu and Trump are complicit in making this happen. And it's an absolute screaming shame.
Well, Tom Friedman in the New York Times wrote a pretty aggressive editorial on that issue.
Yeah.
Now, with Trump's tax returns, he's fighting a new way in order to prevent New York from releasing the tax returns, claiming that New York's initiative is in coordination with House Democrats.
So,
and
is that illegal?
And to end this segment, Trump has claimed that ISIS has been defeated, but an IG report just came out that says that, in fact, from the combined joint task force operation called Inherent Resolve, that ISIS, while we have been diminishing troops to less than 1,000 troops, ISIS has over 18,000 fighting members with a war chest of over $400 million.
Are you speaking Iraq or Afghanistan or where?
Syria.
Syria?
In Iraq as well, because there's also other reports that, in fact, that ISIS is making quite some heavy gains in Afghanistan as we're negotiating with the Taliban to remove ourselves from Afghanistan.
Yeah, and we need to be very clear with ourselves that we largely created this, that Osama bin Laden was this obscure guy who had at the most around 5,000 people who were actual hardcore supporters. 20,000 people had been through his camps, you know, as graduates. But he was a fringe element in a fringe part of Islam and, you know, in a fringe part of the world. And George W. Bush elevated him to the status of Lex Luthor, of, you know, the world's largest villain, and then failed to kill him or get him. And all of this now has come about as a result of that. It's pretty breathtaking.
Right now, Trump is meeting with the Romanian prime minister, and we'll find out what words are said later today.
Romanian prime minister. Interesting. Okay. Doug Christian with Talk Media News. Thank you, Doug.
Thanks.
Appreciate the news report. I've got an important message for all my listeners. Economists will tell you that rising gold prices are an indicator of a failing currency. Well, gold is already up over 10% just since January and up over 33% in the last 3 years. What is all this really telling us? Well, the last crash was just a warning. It's only been papered over with trillions of dollars in new debt, and statistically, the next crash is already overdue. This reality has pushed the demand for precious metals to price levels not seen in nearly 6 years. The time to buy gold is now, before the crash and before the next price increase. The big questions everyone asks are, who can I trust and what types of gold do I buy? Call my friends at ITM Trading at 1-888-OWN-GOLD. The proper gold and silver strategy will help secure all your major assets, including your entire wealth portfolio. Call ITM Trading at 1-888-OWN-GOLD. Ask them for their free gold protection guide and secure your wealth while you still can. That's 1-888-OWN-GOLD. 1-888-OWN-GOLD.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For the Tom Hartman Book Club, our book today is How Wealth Rules the World, Saving Our Communities and Freedoms from the Dictatorship of Property by Ben G. Price, with a blurb on the back from some guy named Tom Hartman. This is from the introduction, One Right to Rule Them All, The Dark Side of Property. Let's get it out in the open. The United States of America, nations that emulate its governing principles, are governed by a dictatorship of property. Is that plutocracy? Sure. But it goes deeper than that. The U.S. Constitution, as it was written and later interpreted by the Supreme Court, hijacked democratic rights that American revolutionaries thought they had won. The Federalists developed a whole system of law that serves the interests of wealth. Elements of that system include the following: state constitutions untethered from their revolutionary moorings, international trade agreements that supersede local, state, and federal laws, regulations administered by an unrepresentative bureaucracy, political parties that gerrymander legislative districts so that they can choose their voters rather than allowing voters to choose their representatives, corporate property that the Supreme Court has declared to be persons with Bill of Rights protections, federal and state statutes that privatize public governance and prohibit democratic limits on the uses of private fortunes, and local governments declared to be property of the state and made unavailable to communities for municipal lawmaking. We live deep within an undemocratic matrix of law that masquerades as a democratic republic while it legalizes an aristocracy of wealth. The U.S. Constitution was written by men who came from a uniformly privileged class. Charles Beard argued this point in his book, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. Beard analyzed the economic interests of those who met in secret to overturn the Articles of Confederation and concluded that the Federalists were motivated by economic self-interest to establish a form of government that would protect their wealth against an excess of democracy, as Alexander Hamilton put it. The Federalists who replaced the Articles with the U.S. Constitution were not fully aligned with the liberating agenda of commoners who risked their lives to throw off the hierarchical chains of Great Britain. They were wealthy men educated in British law with opinions that harmonized with aristocratic sentiments. The authors of the U.S. Constitution are often called the Founding Fathers. Popular history lumps the Federalist counter-revolutionaries in with the likes of Thomas Paine, who with his firebrand writings against monarchy, nobility, and special privilege for the few, inspired the people to demand independence. Popular culture counts the Federalists as American revolutionaries no less fervent for liberty than the men whose ideas of leveling the social class system inspired American farmers and day laborers to pick up their muskets and take on the Redcoats. This conflation of the Federalist counter-revolutionaries with those whose spirit of 76 is reflected in the Declaration of Independence and absent from the U.S. Constitution is a troubling reminder that popular history too often preserves false memories. What's the evidence that the Federalists intended a constitution that weaponizes law to protect the accumulation of property and raise wealth and out of reach of public governance? Well, to begin with, their own words were recorded in Philadelphia in 1787 by James Madison and Robert Yates. Damningly, that record was held secret until every delegate to the clandestine conclave had died and the Constitution they wrote had been the law of the land for two generations. We have that evidence, and it tells the tale I'll share in Chapter 2. We also have the product of their cleverness to consider. The Federalists established a quasi-monarchical judiciary. Politically appointed judges wielded the power to veto any legislation that departs from the Federalists' original intent to protect wealthy accumulation from democratic oversight. We have the arguments of the anti-Federalists who called out the would-be American aristocrats for betraying the Revolution. If not for them, we would not have the first 10 amendments to the Federalist document, the Bill of Rights, which many identify as the soul of the U.S. Constitution. More immediate evidence that the original intent of the U.S. Constitution was to immunize possession of unearned property from public regulation can be found in the antisocial way the document is interpreted by the courts and how it operates on society today. Here's my argument in a nutshell. We are faced with social, political, and environmental problems that resist resolution because law empowers a wealthy minority to govern based on priorities often at odds with the general welfare. The Constitution, and its interpretation by the courts, amounts to an arsenal of weaponized law able to deliver special privileges to a propertied class. Certain legal mechanisms let those seeking to profit at the public expense block policies that compete with their interests. These legal doctrines operate by a two-step process. First, they remove democratic rights from the public sphere and deposit them in concentrated accumulations of property. The oddity of attaching legal rights to property itself rather than to people roared into public consciousness with the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United ruling that affirmed corporate property's personhood and free speech rights. Although the ruling shocked the conscience of average Americans, it was not the first time the court had vested civil rights within inert property. Nor were corporations the first type of property to be given legal rights. The second step is for property imbued with rights to deliver those rights as an extra layer of legal privilege to the property owner. When civil and human rights are deposited in property, that property is placed beyond the authority of the people to govern how it is used by its owner. This nullifies the majority's ability to decide directly or through elected representatives what public policy will be. As a result, we aren't allowed to resolve issues of immediate concern to every community. Even when we understand what needs to be done, we're often blocked. And then he goes through the whole list. Benji Price writes, "How wealth rules the world." Right now on the line with us is Ben G. Price, the author of a new book. It's called How Wealth Rules the World, Saving Our Communities and Freedoms from the Dictatorship of Property. Ben, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks a lot for having me, Tom.
I should add, Ben is also the National Organizing Director for CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF.org. And howwealthrulestheworld.com is the website, and you can tweet Ben at Ben G. Price. The dictatorship of property. I mean, you open the book in your introduction, first sentence, the first paragraph. Let's get it out in the open. The United States of America and nations that emulate its governing principles are governed by a dictatorship of property. What do you mean?
Well, I'm not talking about people who own cars and homes. We're talking about really the amassing of property, the amassing of wealth into fewer and fewer hands. But this dictator of property isn't really about the ownership itself. We certainly have a real problem with the disparity between wealth and poverty and the disparity between workers and bosses and so forth. But what we're really focusing on in the book here is that we have a system of law that favors and does a lot more than favor, actually sets up a system that allows those who control the greatest amount of wealth to have the greatest amount of governing authority. And this goes back to the Federalists who drafted the U.S. Constitution following their overturning of the Articles of Confederation and turning their backs on really the aspirations that were put forward in the Declaration of Independence by the revolutionaries.
So how does this play out today?
Well, that's the thing that I really wanted to capture in the book was the contrast between what the aspirations of revolutionaries were, what the Federalists, and just to be clear, they were counter-revolutionaries and of a quite a different stripe and opinion than the folks who fought that revolution and who should be rightly called the Founding Fathers rather than the Federalists. But also through the book, contrasting what was put together and how private law was sewn into the public law of our U.S. Constitution to protect private interests and wealth, and how that plays out today in our communities. And I've been working for about 15 years now with communities that have been trying to protect themselves against large corporate projects in the fracking fields of the U.S., the extraction of so-called natural gas. I think it's natural when it's left in the ground, not when they pull it into the open and contribute to the climate crisis that we're experiencing. But the inability of the people in our communities to engage in community self-government and to govern the behavior of people hiding behind the corporate veil with limited liability protections, which means that they're above the law. They're not responsible to the communities that they're doing harm to. And those corporations working hand in hand with our state and federal governments and being protected by our so-called justice system in ways that make it impossible for citizens to enact local laws to protect their rights, to protect their health and safety, and to protect their natural environments from destruction. It plays out in these current battles where our municipal communities are being treated like resource colonies and sacrifice zones. That's the reality of it. It's what I've seen up front and close up and personal. And it's becoming more broadly understood that the system that we're working and laboring under is, well, it's not broken. It's fixed. It's been fixed like a crooked game of cards.
As in the fix is in, yeah.
The fix is in. And so the question raised throughout the book and after going through how the system works, it really is about how does wealth, how does the accumulated concentration of property into fewer and fewer hands, how does that translate into a system where that 1% that's been identified, the Occupy movement, the 1% versus the 99%, how is it that that small, small minority actually gets to set policy and gets to forbid the rest of the population from standing in the way of their profit making?
Right. Well, you know, I mean, this is what Gillens and Page pointed out in that landmark study a couple of years ago, is that the interest, the legislative interests of the top 1% have something like a 70% correlation between what they want and what they get. Of the top 10%, it's like a 60% correlation or something like that, if I'm remembering right. I'm guessing you probably know this much better than me. And for the bottom 90%, there is literally no correlation between what they want and what Congress passed as legislation. In fact, the phrase that they used was that it was the equivalent of random noise. It is completely, you know, the desires of the bottom 90% are completely ignored by our political system. So short of rewriting our Constitution, which ain't going to happen any day soon, what do we do?
Well, it absolutely, that study illustrates just those things. But what has been needed since then, and it was what I was concerned about, is why is it, not just why, but how does that process work? What are the mechanisms? And is it just corruption? Is it just buying off legislators and judges? And no, the answer is that even if we elect the perfect pal of democracy, put him in their office, and you find that, you know, the program that they're allowed to run in terms of governing process does not allow them to create the outcomes that actually represent the interests of the majority. You know, it's true that we're not going to overturn or change the U.S. Constitution overnight. The one thing that has been happening, and I've been working with communities at the local level for 15 years now, is that they've been enacting local laws that challenge the system, that challenge the claim that rights that are vested in corporate property, you know, the idea that that whole corporate personhood thing, we get lost in that. We get lost in what's wrong with Citizens United and so forth. And I'd say that if we overturned Citizens United, we would not have done nearly enough to fix the problems that we face.
No, I get that.
Yeah.
You know, totally. But from the point of view of a person who's listening to this interview right now, who's thinking, okay, in the next, you know, year and a half as we're running up to this election, I can do something. I can lobby my legislators. I can get my friends to sign petitions. Where should they be focusing their attention? Or I can campaign for a particular candidate who's talking about changing the system in ways that are more consonant with what you're talking about, Ben. What is your advice to that person?
Tom, I'm going to say something that may be controversial, and that is that begging the legislators that have enacted the laws that keep us in the box and control is probably not going to get us what we want. That voting your favorite candidate into office may improve things compared to where they are, but it's not going to change the system.
So what should people do then?
No. We have to do what the civil rights activists did. We have to confront the obstruction of democracy. We have to do lunch counter sit-ins, if you will, but that's not the model. That's the type of thing.
So what's the model?
We have to bring attention to the fact that we're being deprived of the right of self-determination in places where we live. And that means making local law that is, even if it's preempted by the state or federal government, if it is in protection of the rights of the people and to protect our own home base, our environment.
No, I get that, Ben, and I'm totally supportive of you and the work that CELDEF are doing, and CELDEF has been, you know, helping communities pass these laws all over the country, but you've never had one that was sustained.
Well, we don't expect any more than under Plessy versus Ferguson that made segregation by race perfectly legal and constitutional, according to the Supreme Court. During years and years after the Civil War, we thought we had ended slavery, and right, what we had is apartheid. What could possibly change that? Well, not asking the courts if it would be okay if we ignore what they've said wasn't okay, and that was integration. So we have to turn our backs on the courts. This is controversial.
Although it was the court that overturned Plessy in Brown v. Board.
Well, not until the towns were in an uproar, not until the people had stood up and said, we will not accept this.
Right.
And the courts have been pretty studious about reversing and chipping away at those decisions from the late 50s and early 60s as well, and the Voters' Rights Act and so forth. And so what we didn't get, interestingly, what we didn't get when the courts ruled on those decisions was an absolute constitutional right of the people not to be discriminated against. Right. What we got was decisions that were grounded in the Commerce Clause that said that businesses that engaged in commerce could not discriminate
Great book, How Wealth Rules the World by Ben Price. Check out celdef.org too, celdef.org, and check out the extraordinary work that they're doing. It is a long, long battle.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. Sandra in Pensacola, Florida. Hey, Sandra, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
I just was listening to your conversation between your last guest, and you said something about 70% of the one percenters get what they want.
No, they get it 70% of the time. Yeah.
70% of the time. Okay. And the 10%ers get it 60% of the time?
Yeah, those aren't exact numbers, but it's, you know, you can look up the study.
Right. I just wondered, when does a country enter into an oligarchy?
We're there. We're there. Jimmy Carter on this. Yeah, on this program 3 years ago, 4 years ago, whenever it was, Jimmy Carter came on and I asked him what he thought about Citizens United. The clip lives on YouTube. You can easily find it. And he said, I said, is the United States still a democracy? What do you think Citizens United means? And he says, we're now an oligarchy. We're run by oligarchs, by the rich.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's what I needed to know. I just needed to know whether we were still in a democracy.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't seem like we are.
I think not. I agree with you, Sandra, and I agree with Jimmy Carter, and we've got to do something about it. And this is going to be this is the big struggle of our time that the media won't discuss, because the media is also owned by these same oligarchs that are controlling our political system. Patricia in Vashon, Washington. Hey, Patricia, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Well, I just want to say something. You know, you had a person on that was talking about people should be doing more civil disobedience and protesting, and I think Representative Procan has gone through that, too. And I've been arrested a lot, somewhere between 65 and 100 times, which has been proven in a courtroom. And I just want to say that I don't think people should be, especially representatives and important people, should be saying that people should be doing civil disobedience. This is an individual decision to make, and there's a lot of really threatening things that happen that can affect your life.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. You've been arrested many times doing civil disobedience. Is that what you're talking about, Patricia?
Yeah. So, I mean, things can happen from the police while you're being arrested. Things can happen in jail. When you get out, you may not be able to get a job, depending upon where you live. You may not be able to get housing or have a hard time getting housing.
Yeah.
You have been given no financial help or promise of the group that you're with that, you know, there will be a place to live and some kind of work to do. So this is a real serious decision, and it shouldn't be taken lightly.
Yes, I agree. I absolutely agree. Patricia, thank you. Spot on. James in Minneapolis, listening on AM 950. Hey, James, what's up?
This is in response to your guest on the show and what we can do to help fix Citizens United one state at a time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a speaker, Ray Metcalf, on Ralph Nader's show a while back. He's a two-term Alaska state senator who came up with legislation based on the Supreme Court overturning Citizens United.
Are you talking by constitutional amendment?
That's part of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the principal struggle right now. Move to amend.org and citizen.org. There's a bunch of groups that have been proposing explicit, specific constitutional amendments to say corporations are not people and money is not speech. And God bless them, because we need it. James, I got to run. I'm sorry. It's the end of the show. Thanks so much for the call. And thanks for listening to AM 950. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today. It's another fascinating day. We'll be back tomorrow as the freak show in Washington, D.C. rolls on, and we all try to figure out exactly what we can do about it. And there's a lot we can do about it. So anyhow, to get out there, get active, tag, you're it. Democracy is not a spectator sport. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.